we should seize the institutions of the left and turn them against the left. We should just seize the administrative state for our own purposes. Fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, replace them with our people.
Well, good to know your plan, J.D. Vance. I assume it's Trump's plan too.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Spoiler, it is.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, and Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV. Out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Richmond, Virginia's WRWK. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR. And Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from BradBlog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. All right, coming up, we will be joined by the policy director at the nation's largest federal employee union, representing some 750,000 federal workers, to get some insight into what you heard J.D. Vance going on about there at the top of the show, into both Donald Trump's plan and the Project 2025 plan to gut hundreds of thousands of career federal civil service workers and replace them with Trump loyalists should he be able to muscle his way back into the Oval Office this November. And by the way, even though Trump is trying to disavow Project 2025 as, you know, as if he knows nothing about it, Desi Doyen, he hasn't heard, he hates it.
That's what he says, and he never lies.
No, yeah, he hates it. He knows nothing about it, but he knows that he hates it. Go figure. Anyway, as he tries to disavow it, keep in mind that that is, of course, a lie, as the Project 2025 is put together by scores of people from his own administration, and B, Trump already attempted to institute a policy that would have allowed him to fire hundreds of thousands of federal workers and replace them with loyalists in a scheme that was only stopped because he lost in 2020. And also, see, Trump's own campaign website right now has him vowing to, quote, shatter the deep state before going on to promise to gut the federal workforce. Jacqueline Simon will be joining us shortly with details on all of the above and more. But of course, speaking of this year's elections, as we almost always do, we noted on yesterday's program the great Commonwealth of Massachusetts held its congressional and state legislative primary elections on Tuesday. And as expected, there were few, if any, surprises in the deep blue state. In fact, most of the candidates on the ballot on Tuesday ran unopposed entirely, including U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who, according to unofficial results reported today, will be running for a third term in office against Republican John Deaton, who won a three-way race to challenge Warren in November. And while she is expected to easily win in November, I will just remind you that when she originally won office back in 2012, she defeated Republican Scott Brown, Republican senator at the time, Scott Brown. He had won that seat after it was vacated with the death of longtime Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts. So it is not impossible for a Republican to win as a U.S. senator there. But that was, of course, amid the when Scott Brown won, it was amid the GOP fight against what would eventually become the very popular Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And there were at the time a lot of angry, disinformed Republicans purposely terrified by the GOP with false information about Obamacare, that it was going to steal your private insurance plans. It was
death panels.
Take your doctors away. Death panels.
Yeah.
It would socialize the U.S. healthcare system.
Mass hysteria.
Breakdown
of society.
Yes. And of course, you know, kill your grandma with those death panels. Whatever happened to those? Anyway, I guess Republicans were what? Making all that nonsense up? How unusual for them. In any event, as I said, no surprises to date from Tuesday's primary elections in Massachusetts, though I have received a report about a problem with, that initially appeared to be a problem with the optical scanners being unable to tally at least one state house race in the town of Essex that an astute Brad blog follower brought to my attention today because it occurred where he lived. Thankfully, Massachusetts has enough respect for its voters that they are allowed to cast all of their votes on hand-marked paper ballots. So officials were able to hand-count the ballots in question, as they did overnight on Tuesday and into Wednesday, because they could not correctly be scanned by the scanners. So I've been trying to learn more about this throughout the day, but apparently, according to officials at the Secretary of the Commonwealth's office, there was a mistake in the order of the candidates on the Democratic primary ballot on some of the ballots that went out early in Essex. Apparently, the problem was discovered. The new ballots were printed, but that meant that all of the ballots for that race would have to be hand counted, or the result reported by the scanners would mix up the two candidates whose places were switched.
Oh, okay.
on the ballot. Of course, that is just one of the reasons why it's so important that voters be allowed to vote on hand-marked paper ballots. I will let you know if we learn more about what happened there, but I am grateful to listener Mike L., who both alerted me to the issue and was able to get information from the state that was not reported by any of the local media on this issue. So kudos, Mike. Thank you very much. Well done, sir. As also noted yesterday, the final congressional primary day of the year will be next Tuesday in Rhode Island, Delaware, and New Hampshire, with both Delaware and New Hampshire also holding their primaries for governor and for other matters. So if you live in any of those three states, this is, once again, a fantastic chance to make sure that you are properly registered to vote for this November's election. By the way, vote-by-mail balloting for the 2024 presidential election is finally and officially getting underway for reals this Friday,
beginning
in the great battleground state of North Carolina, believe it or not.
Wow.
Where Harris and Trump are said to be deadlocked, according to pre-election polling averages, in a state that Trump won in both 2016 and 2020, but this year could go either way. It has been winnable for Democrats as recently as 2008, back when Barack Obama won the state, albeit very narrowly at the time. But yep, this election is finally happening, Des.
Wow.
Like it or not.
I am not ready for this.
And you should be by
now,
for crying out loud. Anyway, we will be covering it closely. We will be covering both the horse race and the track conditions that the horses are running on, as always, both of them closely. First up, speaking of the U.S. Senate, while Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are locked in a very close race, not just in North Carolina, but everywhere, and Democrats seem to believe they will be able to regain a majority in the U.S. House this year. We'll see about that. The U.S. Senate is a different matter, and it may be very difficult for Democrats to hold on to their currently very narrow 51-49 seat majority, with right-wing Democrat Joe Manchin retiring from the Senate this year. His seat is almost certain to flip from blue to red. That would, on its own, put the Senate at 50-50 at that point if Democrats are able to hold all of the other seats that they're currently defending this year. The Democrats would be able to retain control of the majority in a 50-50 Senate if they win the White House, which would allow Vice President Tim Walz to become President of the Senate and the tie-breaking vote in a 50-50 Senate. However, if Democrats hang on to all of their current seats other than West Virginia, but also lose their seat in Montana this year, where three-term Democratic Senator John Tester is in a very tough battle to win another term, then Republicans would regain majority control of the upper chamber, making the path for progress by a Democratic White House much harder than it might be otherwise.
And God knows what would happen if there is a Supreme Court justice seat that comes up.
There you go. Yeah. Thanks for making it even scarier, Dennis. Appreciate
that.
But on the agenda itself, legislative agenda, as Jonathan Martin notes at Politico today, if that were to happen, if John Tester cannot hold on in Montana, Kamala Harris would be the first Democrat to enter the presidency since 1884 without majorities in both chambers, if the Republicans are able to flip the Senate this year. So the story last week from the Charcoosta News, which describes itself as the official news publication of the Flathead Indian Reservation, is actually or potentially a rather important one that's being picked up today a few days later by major outlets where it is finally getting some coverage. As one of those outlets covering it, The Guardian, in this case, reports that a Republican candidate in a race that could decide control of the U.S. Senate made disparaging comments about Native Americans at campaign fundraising events last year. He did so repeatedly, according to recordings disclosed in local media. Yes, the Charcoosta News. Good on them. Tim Sheehy, the wealthy cattle rancher who moved to Montana some years ago and has been endorsed by Donald Trump in his bid to become senator for Montana, made the remarks repeatedly at a series of gatherings where he boasted of cultivating ties and bonding with members of the Crow Reservation, the official home of the indigenous Crow tribe. In one clip, Sheehy is asked if he has been campaigning at Montana's various Native American reservations. This was, I believe, in November of last year. In Montana, indigenous tribes make up about 6% of the population. It is home to 7 reservations, 12 different tribes. And Sheehy boasts about roping with folks on the res and riding in a parade on the Crow Reservation, where he said, if they don't like you there, well, apparently they throw beer cans at you.
Yes, so I was already at the Crow Res. One of our ranch units actually is down the Crow Res, so I rope there every year with them. And if you want a tough crowd when you're roping, rope on the Crow Res, you know? You miss that double heel shot as a Coors Light can on the side of your head. You're like, yeah, light boy, you know? So, it's a tough crowd, but, rode through their parade there in July, or early August.
Okay, so if they don't like you on the Crow Res, they throw a can of a beer at you, I guess. Maybe it was just a joke that day. He could have said, you know, they throw a bottle of water at you or they throw a can of Coke at your head, but that's not what he said. He said they throw a Coors Light at your head. And as it turns out, the references specifically to a Coors Light can being thrown at you on the Indian reservation, well, similar comments were recorded at 3 different gatherings, according to the Charcoosta News, which covers the Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana. But he specifically said Coors Light because, you know, that's what Indians do. Because, you know, well, they drink a lot, don't they, Tim?
6 weeks after our lunch, one of the first things I did was I strapped a Sheehy sign to a horse and rode through the Crow Res parade. And if you know a tough crowd,
want to go to the ProRes. That's, you know, they let you know whether they like you or not. There's Coors Light cans flying by your head driving by, but you know, they respect that. You go with, you go with the action as they say, hey, that guy's not that bad, you know. Yeah, the horse rode through the parade. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Man, I threw a beer can at his head, didn't even flinch. Oh, that guy. Like, all right.
Yeah, he's pretty cool. Threw a beer can at his head. He didn't even flinch. And then Tim Sheehy, again, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, at yet another Republican fundraiser, to uproarious laughter again, because you know how those Indians are with their beer. Well, he made the same joke again.
I rode my horse right through the ProRes festival with signs strapped to me. And, you know, one of our ranching operations is on the ProRes, so every year I'm down there. I rope and grab my own cows, I cut and bale my own hay. And I tell you, if you don't make that double heel shot on the res, you know, the Coors Light can't fly on the side of your head. You know, they let you know right away. Hey, yeah, nice shot, man. So it's a tough crowd. But I hopped on my horse, rode right through their parade and said, yep, I'm here. I'm a Republican. And I'm on this reservation telling you that I care about your issues. I ranch on your reservation. A lot of them know me.
Yeah, I care about your issues. I ranch on your reservations. Where you guys just love throwing Coors Light cans at each other because, you know, Indian. Now, to be fair, maybe Tim Sheehy was just telling it. Maybe he's just telling a joke about beer cans getting thrown at you. He didn't mean that as any kind of slight against Indians, despite the old, very offensive trope about drunk Indians. Doesn't call them Native Americans, seems to call them Indians. Perhaps he didn't mean it that way at all. It was just a joke. You know, he could have said Coke, but he got it in his head, Coors Light. Except then there was also this clip in which he told the story just a little bit differently in Shelby, Montana, about ranching with a friend of his from the Crow Reservation. Some of my best friends are from the Crow Reservation. you know, he described it as a great way to bond with the Native Americans. But this time, and it's a little bit hard to hear, but he adds something else to the story.
So I, my ranching partner and one of my really good friends is Turk Stovall. He's a Crow Indian. We ranched together on the Crow Res. So I'm pretty involved down there. Rode through their Crow Res, their annual Crow Fair Parade this year. And I rope and ran with them every year, you know, down there. So, great way to bond with all the Indians to be out there while they're drunk at 8 a.m. and you're roping together. Every heel shot you miss, you get a Coors Light can instead.
Drunk in the a.m.
A great way to bond with all the Indians. If you get out there while they're drunk at 8 a.m. and you're roping together. That's not good, it seems to me.
No.
Desi, of course, you have Native American background
heritage.
Heritage. How does that bounce off of you? Like a Coors can at 8 a.m. with all those drunk Indians? What is your thoughts on that?
I find it totally appalling and not at all surprising. I mean, for this, you know, this white Republican to be basically two-faced. I mean, he's nice to them in person, and then he is, you know, laughing at their expense behind their backs with all of these old racist tropes and derogatory stereotypes. I mean, and he's clearly speaking to a white audience because I really doubt he'd say that to their faces on the Crow Reservation.
And they sure loved it, though, at those four different times at those Republican fundraisers. They thought it was hilarious.
Yes, they did. Telling, isn't it?
As The Guardian reports, Sheehy is 37 years old. He's a former Navy SEAL. He moved to Montana just 10 years ago. He's trying to unseat John Tester, the incumbent, in a contest viewed crucial to the Republican quest to retake control of the Senate, where Democrats have a narrow 51-49 majority. Revelation of his comments could undermine his efforts, however. According to the outlet, as previously noted, indigenous tribes make up 6% of the population of Montana and home to 7 reservations and 12 tribes. Polls currently show the two parties' candidates locked in a tight race, with the most recent aggregate of 13 voter surveys published by The Hill, giving Sheehy a 3.5-point lead over Tester. In a state that trends very heavily Republican, Donald Trump won there in 2020 by almost 20 points. How Tester keeps winning there year after year is incredible. we'll see if he can pull it off again. He, unlike Sheehy, is a native-born Montanan who is trying to paint Sheehy, who has been in part bankrolling his own campaign, as a wealthy outsider. The GOP candidate's comments about Crow members are seen as particularly embarrassing because the tribe has been seen as vociferously pro-Trump for some reason. Native Americans have been a key voter bloc for Tester in his three previous successful campaigns, but he has been warned that their support is not guaranteed. Calvin Lime, who lives on another indigenous reservation in the state, called Sheehy's comments, quote, a slap in the face to Crow members, quote, for them to bring him there, work with him. They're happy. They're promoting him. But behind closed doors, they're the drunken Indian, he told the New York Times. Behind closed doors, you're actually getting looked at as a lesser than. News of Sheehy's comments is not the first potentially damaging episode of Sheehy's campaign. Last year, he was also forced on the defensive after sexist and racist Facebook posts allegedly written by him came to light. Well, no wonder the Republicans chose him to challenge Tester. Insiders said the posts made between 2006 and 2008 and since taken down were, quote, full of questionable photos and featured, quote, lewd photos of women, a caricature of Middle Eastern people, and homoerotic jokes. What, no drunken Indian jokes?
He's quite the candidate.
While the Crow Reservation has a population of about 7,900 Native American voters, all of the tribes combined could be decisive in that state if they are allowed to vote, as, yes, Republicans have been for years trying to prevent them from doing in Montana. Earlier this year, the Montana Supreme Court ruled in favor of a collection of Native American organizations and tribes, holding that two state laws that hinder Native American participation in the state's electoral process violate the fundamental right to vote under the Montana Constitution. One measure, HB 176, would have ended Election Day registration. The other, HB 530, aimed to prohibit paid third-party ballot assistance, according to the ACLU, who represented the tribes. Native American voters living on reservations disproportionately rely upon Election Day registration and ballot assistance in order to cast votes in Montana. So naturally, Republicans there tried to make it harder for them to cast their votes. That is why, according to the ACLU, in 2020, two Montana courts struck down a substantially similar measure to HB 530, finding the restriction on ballot collection disproportionately harmful to Native American voters in rural tribal communities. And in March of this year, the Montana Supreme Court found that both HB 176 and HB 530 disproportionately and unconstitutionally burdened the voting rights of Native Americans. And yet they continue to pass these laws over and over again. So what the folks on the Crow Res are thinking in supporting this guy, I don't know. In any event, the decision back in March affirmed September 22 decision from the 13th Judicial District Court in Montana, finding both of those laws unconstitutional. The plaintiffs were the Western Native Voice, Montana Native Vote, the Blackfeet Nation, the Confederate, Salish, and Kootenai tribes of the Flathead Reservation, the Fort Belknap Indian Community, and the Northern Cheyenne Tribe, who filed suit, but not, apparently, the Crow Reservation. Go figure. The plaintiffs hailed the ruling as a great victory back in March, yet another one that they've had to wage as Republicans continue to do this, try to disenfranchise Native American voters there. So we'll see if any of this makes a difference for Sheehy this November, but the results could mean nothing less than which party will control the majority for the next 2 years, and if Kamala Harris wins the White House, whether she'll be able to carry out her agenda at all, or if she will be blocked from day one by a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. And speaking of day one agendas, what could happen to our government and the federal workforce in 2025? Asked the 750,000 strong American Federation of Government Employees in a press release last month, before answering that question by saying a group of conservative organizations have a plan, and it is not a good one for federal employees. The plan, they note, is detailed in a blueprint called Project 2025, organized by the far-right Heritage Foundation, backed by over 100 right-wing groups. The plan promises a takeover of our country's system of checks and balances in order to, quote, dismantle the administrative state. The operations of federal agencies and programs, according to current law and regulations, including many of the laws and regulations that govern federal employment. So what would that mean for hundreds of thousands of career federal civil service workers who are not political appointees? Well, it ain't good. And it's not only Project 2025 vowing to cut hundreds of thousands of jobs from the civil service to be replaced, if at all, by Trump loyalists. It's also Donald Trump himself. Let's take a quick break and we'll talk about all of that and more with Jacqueline Simon of the American Federation of Government Employees. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It took the assassination of a president in 1881 to finally end what had long been the cozy, back-scratching world of U.S. presidential appointments known as the spoils system. A man named Charles Guiteau believed that he would finally make his mark with a government position based on his work for the Republican Party after the election of James A. Garfield, the 20th president of the United States. He became convinced that Garfield would acknowledge his support of the party and recognize it with a plum position in the U.S. civil service. He zeroed in on an assignment at the U.S. consulate in Paris, though he had no experience whatsoever in the Foreign Service. The U.S. operated for much of its earlier years and into most of the 1800s on the understanding that individuals won jobs with the government not by proving their expertise, but by having connections to presidents and their parties. Garfield was a former Civil War general whose problem with the spoils system went well beyond Guiteau. Garfield quickly took a stand after entering the White House by challenging a powerful U.S. senator and influence peddler who thrived on such patronage. The system at the time even required those rewarded with jobs to kick some of their salaries back to their political parties. But Guiteau's appointment never came. He became infuriated and began stalking the president. Garfield had been in office for about 4 months when Guiteau fired two shots that mortally wounded the president as he walked through a Washington train station. Guiteau fantasized that a sympathetic country would revere him for his actions. Instead, he was hanged for murder. Congress, about 18 months after Garfield's assassination, moved to finally eliminate the spoils system in 1883, after the disgruntled job seeker assassinated the man that he believed had owed him a government appointment. Garfield's successor, President Chester A. Arthur, signed the Pendleton Act, which replaced the spoils system with a federal civil service made up of career employees. It required minimum qualifications and forbade political kickbacks and eventually would lead to objective testing for many job applicants in the system of federal workers that we now know today. The next 22 presidents would leave that basic principle of the civil service intact, at least until Donald Trump took office. In past statements and an executive order issued while he was in office, Donald Trump demonstrated that he hopes to exert control over a huge swath of the government workforce, not merely the roughly 4,000 employees traditionally subject to presidential appointments, but as the notorious 900-page Project 2025 manifesto created by about 100 Republican-aligned think tanks and scores of former Trump administration officials promises, about 500,000 career civil service employees could be replaced with a spoils system-styled Trump loyalist program if he regains the White House this fall. After one term as president, in which his promise to remake the massive federal government mostly came up short, Trump again is raining fury on the, quote, deep state, pledging that if he is elected in November, he will replace career civil servants with his like-minded allies. If Trump and Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance were to succeed in remaking the federal workforce in the way they have described it, it would be the most radical reconfiguration of the U.S. government in 140 years. Quote, you're now talking about 140 years of presidential administrations, Republican and Democrats, who all supported the proposition that the best way to get an effective government was to have a career, professional, merit-based civil service, said Max Steyer, the president of the Partnership for Public Service, a nonprofit that analyzes federal agencies and their employees, in an interview with James Rainey of the LA Times recently. Quote, so the idea that we would convert that or return to a 19th century style spoils system is a huge anomaly. It is a radical change, said Steyer. But Trump has made clear he does not intend to be dissuaded by those who have worked within the government before. The Republican presidential candidate recently offered his emphatic endorsement of a house cleaning when a YouTube personality asked whether he would restore trust in government by holding federal workers accountable.
How are you going to gain the trust back of the American people within the government? And are we going to see anybody held accountable?
Yeah. The answer is yes on the second. They're going to be held accountable. They've got to be held accountable. What they're doing, they're destroying this country. They're crooked people. They're dishonest people. They're going to be held accountable.
They're crooked people. Who are they? Why are they crooked? And who exactly will be held accountable and for what? The disgraced former president has made clear his disdain, for example, for the FBI, federal prosecutors, and others who investigated him over his efforts to steal the 2020 election, among other things. But he has said little about others that he might consider, quote, crooked, or which agencies and job categories he would target in the federal workforce. Would those ousted include scientists and engineers who support clean energy programs like wind and solar power and electric vehicles that Trump has ridiculed? Would economists at the nonpartisan Bureau of Labor Statistics find themselves on the street if they were to produce numbers that the businessman did not like as president? Trump's vice presidential running mate, J.D. Vance, appears to share the view of that those who enter civil service for the U.S. government should be replaced. As a Senate candidate, he told a podcaster back in 2021, while speculating that Trump was likely to run again in 2024 and win that time, that largely the entire civil service should be removed and, in his words, replace them with our people. And if the courts tried to stop Trump, well, he should simply defy the federal courts.
We should just seize the administrative state for our own purposes. We should fire all of the people. I mean, I think that what Trump should do, like if I was giving him one piece of advice, fire every single mid-level bureaucrat, every civil servant in the administrative state, replace them with our people. And when the courts, because you will get taken to court, and then when the courts stop you, stand before the country, like Andrew Jackson did and say the Chief Justice has made his ruling, now let him enforce it.
Wow. In the waning months of his tenure in office back in 2020, Donald Trump tried to do exactly that. He created a category of employees that should be placed on a new so-called Schedule F that would classify them as at-will employees who can be fired at any time for any reason. But Trump left office before Schedule F could be completed and veteran civil servants ejected. Now, some analysts have estimated that Schedule F could threaten the positions of tens of thousands of workers. The American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE, representing some 750,000 workers across many unions, said that the Trump policy would erase employee protections for up to 500,000 senior managers, high-level technical specialists, physicians, and others. Those senior workers would not only lose collective bargaining rights laid out in the law, but the change, according to Jackie Simon, the Federation's public policy director, would, quote, eviscerate the apolitical, merit-based system that we have today and replace it with a corrupt spoils system. Yes, just like the one that we did away with nearly 150 years ago. Joining us now is Jacqueline Simon, who represents AFGE on all policy matters affecting the union's members, including civil service protections, collective bargaining, privatization, pay, health insurance, retirement, and budget. Oh, Jackie Simon, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast.
Thank you for having me.
So before we get into the threats promised by Project 2025, which Trump has tried to disavow, it seems that by his own words and actions, even as president, that he intends to do what Project 2025 essentially, you know, calls for, as evidenced at the very least by this Schedule F executive action that he put in place as president to potentially, you know, categorize tens of thousands of career federal workers as at-will employees who can be fired at any time. So what type of government workers would potentially be affected, become fireable without cause, I guess, as Schedule F employees?
Well, before I answer that question directly, I do want to say that while Schedule F itself is horrible, and it's everything you've described it to be, in some ways, it's just the logical conclusion of something that's been going on in the federal government now for many years, and that is to take more and more federal jobs out of the competitive service, what we are referring to when we talk about the apolitical professional civil service, mm-hmm. and allow direct appointment to positions. Now, Schedule F is a little bit different from that because they truly are at will, can be fired for any reason or no reason. And of course, the flip side of being able to be fired for any reason or no reason is a hiring process mm-hmm. that would not subject people to the kinds of assessments that are part of the merit system. You know, all these jobs are called accepted service. They're supposed to be the exception to mm-hmm. the rule, which is the competitive service. And the competitive service is based on this idea that, you know, all Americans should have a right to an opportunity to apply for and compete for any federal job that they have the qualifications for, that, you know, that they can perform those duties. And when you take competition out of it and just do direct appointments, you know, you're on the road already to Schedule F, and so much hiring right now is already performed that way. And so, you know, this is just the sort of final dagger in the heart of the civil service. But the civil service has been under tremendous threat for a long time by all these alternative hiring processes. And well, anyway, but just to go back, I mean, I don't know how much you want me to talk about Schedule F.
Well, I was interested in one of the points you made in particular, that these workers who could be placed into Schedule F would lose their collective bargaining rights that are laid out by law. I mean, how can that be? Can an executive order, which is not a law, simply remove, you know, the right for these federal workers to be represented by a union?
Oh, definitely. But that's hardly the only group of federal employees that Project 2025 would strip of collective bargaining rights. Mm-hmm. In the chapter on the Department of Homeland Security, for example, the Ken Cuccinelli, mm-hmm. former secretary and former Virginia state official, mm-hmm. He's the author of that particular chapter. He proposes to exploit the national security loophole in the law to exclude all the groups of federal employees in DHS that don't usually support Donald Trump. So that would be FEMA, mm-hmm. Transportation security officers, the airport screeners, people who work for CIS, who process immigration applications, mm-hmm. and so on. They also, of course, propose to privatize all of TSA.
Go back to
pre 9/11 and just have everything completely privatized. They don't want a professional airport screening workforce. They want to go back. And I think that, you know, I think a good way to look at what the outline of what government would look like according to Project 2025. You know, they've got three ways of ruining the government. One is the one you're talking about right now, which is politicizing the work of people who are right now performing all kinds of functions that you described in your intro, uh-huh. scientific research, the sort of research that underlays regulations that protect public health, clean air, clean water, safe food, all of those kinds of things. They want to get rid of, you know, everything, move things to the states, or privatize, mm-hmm. or defund. Those are their major ways. And those efforts can also be avenues to politicize the work of the federal government. When you privatize, you can specify exactly what the contractor will do and won't do.
Can this all be done at the presidential level? In other words, aren't there a lot, for example, Trump's specific targets remain hazy, notes the LA Times, but the Project 2025 report suggests a few of the type of folks who might be laid off. One would be, for example, workers in the Clean Energy Core project that was launched under the bipartisan infrastructure law to improve distribution of electricity from sources. But Project 2025 calls that a partisan political agenda and calls for eliminating all positions and personnel hired under that program. But isn't that the law? How do they work around the law to do this?
First of all, that's really small potatoes when you're talking about the plans laid out in Project 2025. Mm-hmm. They would take up all testing development and testing away from the CDC. Mm-hmm. They would really, really deregulate the inspection of meat and poultry that's performed right now in the Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. You know, completely privatize the work that's done on by civilians in the Department of Defense at depots and arsenals where weapon systems are maintained and repaired, so that the government would be fully at the mercy of its contractors. Mm. And then, you know, the biggest part of our union, over a third of the membership of our union, works for the Department of Veterans Affairs. And there are already two laws on the books that, you know, it depends on how broadly or narrowly the laws are interpreted. They make no bones about the fact that they would effectively shut down the VA healthcare system and privatize all of that. They would close hospitals and clinics all across the country and basically turn the VA into a private health insurance program. I mean, there's so many ways that that the operations of government and the functions of government would be corrupted, undermined, politicized, by privatization and by, of course, this personnel system that would allow them to hire people who aren't competent, who can't perform the duties of the position, and then hire them and fire them at will.
And well, when I was asking about the Clean Energy Corps, it was not because it was the most terrifying thing in this terrifying plan, but rather because it was a part of a bipartisan law, the bipartisan infrastructure law. And I'm just trying to understand, is this a matter of you had cited the national security loophole? Is this something that they can cite to just basically say, well, never mind the law, we're going to do what we want to do? Or is this more like what J.D. Vance said, is that, you know, hey, if you don't like it, take us to court. And if the court, even if the court tells us we can't do it, you know, you and what army, as they say. I'm trying to figure out how they do this by regulation as opposed to law.
Are you an attorney? Did I hear that at the opening?
You did not, although I've been accused of that in the past.
All right. Well, the Supreme Court recently issued a very, very bad decision having to do with the authority of executive branch agencies to interpret laws through the development of regulations. Mm-hmm. Prior to that decision, a law that you're the one you're talking about would be in order to implement it, it would require regulations. Mm-hmm. It would instruct the agency on how the law would be implemented. Mm-hmm. And since that authority has been constricted, shall we say, tremendously by that Supreme Court decision, when you ask questions like, well, wait a second, they passed a law.
Right.
They have to be able to implement the law. You know, there's many, many, many ways to interpret the language of a law in a narrow way or a broad way. Mm-hmm. They can write regulations that restrict, you know, what can be done and can't be done and how it's done. So, you know, having the ability to subvert laws passed by the Congress is very much within the president's purview. They also have what they call this unitary executive theory.
Yeah.
That also interprets the powers of the president to be so far reaching that a president can do anything he wants, mm-hmm. as we now know, with impunity. Mm-hmm. And part of the interpretation of that law or that concept is that all federal employees should be at will, and that everybody in the executive branch should be is effectively a political appointee, answerable to the president and answerable to the president's political agenda.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and another thing, you know, besides Schedule F that, you know, would be extremely problematic. However many people are actually, it's not people, it's positions. However many positions are reclassified as Schedule F, what would affect every federal employee is a new pay system that's based on performance appraisals, like a pay for performance system. Mm. And they would make adherence to President Trump's agenda either the most important factor or a very important factor in evaluating somebody's performance and deciding whether they get a pay raise or not. Mm-hmm. Now, right now, that would pretty much require them to change the law. But they do have the ability to determine how performance appraisals will happen. And they can pretty much decide based on those kinds of performance appraisals how anybody's career would develop, whether you would ever move up the chain, any kind of career ladder, or whether you'd be just stuck at the bottom if you have been found to be inadequately enthusiastic about Donald Trump.
And it sure is beginning to sound a lot more like the spoil system of the 1800s,
sure.
When you described it that
Absolutely.
Way. Now, you mentioned earlier, Jackie Simon, that jobs are being shipped from D.C. to elsewhere. I know that during Trump's first term, he did something like that. And on his own website, this is not Project 2025, which he's tried to disavow, but on his own website, he says, quote, on day one, he will reissue the 2020 executive order restoring the president's authority to fire rogue bureaucrats. He says, I will shatter the deep state and restore government that is controlled by the people. And he goes on to promise, quote, up to 100,000 government positions could be moved out of Washington. He, as I said, he did something like this during his first term with the Bureau of Land Management and the USDA, moving them to Colorado and Kansas City. What was the purpose of that? And what is the hope of moving these positions up to, you know, 100,000 people, as he vows on his own website? What's the purpose of moving them out of D.C. and elsewhere into the country?
Well, I think it's that's really kind of a rhetorical thing. It's tries to put some, you know, meat on the bone of their claims that that, you know, Washington is this swamp of corruption, and the rest of the United States is, you know, full of real Americans, where people in Washington, D.C. aren't. And so if you would move these government programs and government agencies headquarters elsewhere in the United States, somehow, you know, those jobs would be taken by real Americans rather than the kind of people who live in cities. But one of the things people don't realize is that 85% of the federal workforce works outside of the Washington metropolitan area.
Uh-huh.
You know, most federal employees, the big concentrations of federal employees, work on military bases and in VA facilities. You know, we've got a lot of agencies,
right,
and there are people doing federal government work all over the country. There are laboratories, there are offices all over the country doing, you know, the work of various agencies. You know, we've got Department of Labor, HUD, Social Security Administration, you know, Social Security offices, et cetera, et cetera. But this idea that, yeah, maybe he wants to move the Pentagon. It's headquarters mostly in the Washington area. It's basically agency headquarters. And, you know, they get called all the time to Capitol Hill to testify. And so, you know, if everybody's spread out all over the country who are the kinds of who occupy the kinds of positions, political positions, for the most part, you know, secretaries, undersecretaries, deputy undersecretaries, et cetera, they're the people who Congress wants to hear from on a regular basis. They have to travel back to D.C. for a hearing. You know, it's inefficient. You know, those little examples that happened in his previous term, you know, what ended up happening was most people who had those jobs didn't leave. You know, they had spouses with jobs and kids in school and, you know, what have you, and they weren't going to just completely uproot their entire families because of the whims of Donald Trump.
And so ended up losing a lot of institutional knowledge, I suspect.
Oh, for sure.
On the bargain.
Yeah. I mean, these were economists at the department, you know, agricultural economists who were, you know, that their work was relocated. And of course, you know, they're also fighting right now, you know, remote work and people's ability to telework. I mean, I think that it might be a different kind of situation now. If you'd move a lot of these jobs elsewhere, they could still be performed by people living wherever, given, you know, the technological advances that have allowed people to perform their jobs, you know, from any place. But they don't want that either, of course, because they think if you're not, you know, if the boss isn't watching you, you aren't working.
Well, yeah. And of course, if they send these people out around the country and they can't go, they get replaced by loyalists, which is exactly what they're calling for. Before I let you go, Jackie Simon, the architects of Project 2025 have said that they've gone out of their way to describe this as a policy blueprint, not only for Donald Trump, but for whoever the next Republican may be to enter the White House. Would you expect that this effort would continue into the future, even if Trump ends up losing the election again this year? Is this something we have to keep an eye on year after year at this point?
The answer emphatically is yes, because it's been the Republican playbook for decades. This isn't new. This is Ronald Reagan moving forward. And so almost everything in this document has either been tried before or is part of Republican dogma, Republican agenda in Congress for decades. So not a lot of it is new.
I should also note, before I let you go, that the 750,000 member strong AFGE recently endorsed Kamala Harris for president. I think we know what you don't like about Donald Trump. But beyond that, well, what does your group like about Harris? Why does she win the AFGE endorsement?
Well, when she was in Congress, when she was a senator, she had an extremely pro-AFGE voting record. We keep track of the votes of members of Congress and see how they vote on bills that are of importance to our membership. And she had I don't know if she had 100% voting record, but it was probably close to that. Mm-hmm. And you heard her this weekend in Pittsburgh and in Detroit talking about her support for organized labor and her understanding, along with President Biden, that unions built America and unions built the middle class. And a recognition of that fact has led to her sort of longstanding support for labor unions and collective bargaining. She also headed an effort by the Biden administration to see what they could do through, executive action, but they didn't need Congress. Anything that could be done to promote, worker empowerment and increases in union membership. And so she's just got a very, very good record when it comes to organized labor. And we were there was absolutely no nobody opposed mm-hmm. her having AFGE endorse her. Although we love Joe Biden.
There you go. And he will be missed, but he's still around for a while. Jacqueline Simon is the policy director of the American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE, which is part of the AFL-CIO and the largest federal employee union representing some 750,000 federal and District of Columbia employees. You can find their work at afge.org or on the site still known as Twitter at AFGE. National. Jackie Simon, really appreciate you joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Thank you. Okay. Got to get out, but I'm glad we were able to get to at least some of that. Boy, it's no easy feat covering a 900-page manifesto, be frank.
No, it's not. And there's so much in there that it's kind of mind-blowing what they have planned for everybody.
Yeah, so much in there that still is not being adequately covered. I think people have heard, they're going to shut down the Department of Education, but that is just one part of it.
Yeah, and it's also in Trump's Agenda 47 as well.
So don't let him say, I got nothing to do with 2025. Yep. Yeah. All right. We got to get out. My thanks again to Jackie Simon, to my producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's program, please feel free to stop by bradblog.com and download it or share it with your friends, your family, your enemies. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button at bradblog.com or who just go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Thank you in advance. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We'll see you there until we see you here next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.